This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Class War at Home, Part 3, The Crisis in Healthcare and What is to be Done. One out of three working adults in the United States, that's 57 million workers, have long-term illnesses such as heart disease, diabetes, asthma, or other chronic conditions requiring repeated medical procedures. Yet 75 million people in the United States, that's one-third of the population under 65, 80% of whom, that's 4 out of 5, of whom are working families, with over half of all Hispanic workers and 40% of all Black workers, they went without health care coverage. Compare this to the profitability of the pharmaceutical giants. In 2005, Johnson & Johnson, the mega pharmaceutical company, earned profits of $10 billion. And Pfizer, another pharmaceutical giant, had profits of $8 billion. Now, those statistics come from Fortune magazine. What is to be done? When in the United States, $2.3 trillion annually is gone to purchase health insurance, doctor's visits, medicine, hospital stays, and special tests, according to Families USA. What is to be done? Why is there this terrible disparity here in the United States, considered the wealthiest country in the world? Why do we have this crisis in healthcare? Today on Taking Aim, we continue our discussion, our conversation with Jack Rasmus, the class war at home, and we conclude with a very special discussion of what is to be done. First part, we discussed income inequality and the growing disparity. Last week, we discussed the destruction of pensions, and today, specifically, the crisis in healthcare. Jack Rasmus is on the National Executive Board of the National Writers Union. That's United Auto Workers, 1981, part of the AFL-CIO. He's the chair of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Writers Union. He's been a local union president and an organizer for many years. Holding a PhD in political economy, Jack is also a professor. And most of all, he is an author and playwright, specifically of The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush. It is an incredible documentation, an amazing book, and we suggest you purchase it and read it thoroughly. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning.
And welcome again to Taking Aim. Jack, let's discuss some of the statistics that I was mentioning and the reasons why this is developed in the United States, why we have such a crisis.
Well, you mentioned the huge number of workers who are uninsured, and that's a major, major problem. But that's only part of the crisis in healthcare. About 47 million people in the United States workers out of 134 million private workforce don't have health insurance. They are totally uninsured. Actually, the number is higher than that because in 1999, Clinton, through a little trickery, changed the definition and the way they calculate the uninsured and eliminated 4 million people at that time. It was almost 45 million in 1999. And it dropped down to about 40 million. And ever since then, under George W. Bush, it's risen again rapidly. So it's about 47 million today.
Officially.
And what people don't realize is that 32 million of that 47 million are people who are working. These aren't people on welfare or people without jobs. This is working America, 32 million workers and their entire families. That's how you get that 75 million without any health insurance coverage at all.
And many of them are full-time workers.
Many are full-time, but also one of the major reasons why you have so many is this shift from permanent full-time work to part-time temporary contract, where we talked about in the first session. 45 million of people without a regular full-time permanent job anymore working part-time temporary, and they about 10% of them get any kind of health care. So that growth, as well as the deunionization that's occurred, 14 million fewer union members, are among the major reasons why we have so many people without any health insurance today. In 1980s, for example, 80% of the workforce were covered by health insurance. Today, the number is less than 50%.
So we went from 4 out of 5 to less than one out of two.
Exactly. And, you know, that's only part of the reduction in coverage, total coverage, people without any insurance whatsoever. For those who still remain with some kind of insurance, their coverage has been decreased significantly. In fact, within those who still have some kind of insurance, in particular, dependents and spouses have been dropped from these insurance plans. And retirees who used to have many of them, most of them had some kind of health insurance, no longer have it. So the big attack is not only on eliminating insurance altogether, but eliminating for those who still have it, retirees and dependents. Two-thirds of all retirees used to have health insurance in their retirement in 1988. Today it's down to 30%. So there's this massive, not just no insurance, but massive destruction of health insurance coverage all along the line.
Now, a retiree would be covered by Medicare, but Medicare does not cover fully, and particularly prescription medications, only minimally now, recently, the costs of health care for seniors, people
right.
over 65. So that's why the elimination of retiree health care is particularly onerous.
Not only for those over 65, but a lot of workers retire early for health reasons. You know, they can't work, they're disabled or something like that, or they work 30 years on an assembly line and they're worn out, so they retire at 58, 59, and it's only their retiree health benefits through their job health insurance that has enabled them to really survive, as well as those who are over 65 as the supplement to Medicare.
Well, Jack, in your important article, Medical Mount St. Helens, you gave as an illustration the crisis of the grocery and healthcare workers, which has a particular resonance because when we were both involved in the Million Worker March movement and I was its communications director, we organized support on the picket line and in the San Francisco and Greater Bay area sought to mobilize the rank-and-file workers in this greater area to defend the grocery and healthcare workers who barely earn more than the minimum wage, with a few at $12 to $13 an hour. At most of the big food chains and big city hotels, up to 80% are employed part-time, 90% have to work second jobs 16 to 20 hours a day. But the management and the bosses are demanding a several hundred percent increase in the premiums and deductibles for these workers. Now, as ECL Dye, one of the 50,000 grocery clerks in Northern California, put it, we're all in low pay brackets. We live in little rooms in the city. We can't even dream of owning a house, but they want us to pay more. I work two jobs. How can we pay for health care? Work three jobs? These hotel workers were locked out of 14 international hotel chains. The bosses eliminated health care for 1 out of 4 and then increased the cost for the rest by 15%, which is $300 a month per employee. As Susan Donahue, you cite a cook of 15 years, said, if they treat us this way, how is it going to be in 5 years from now? Well, this is a little encapsulation of the crisis confronting workers across the board. Full-time workers, part-time workers, health care is being eradicated, co-pays are being increased, the premium that is required of workers is being vastly increased, the deductible that is taken away from any benefit is enormously increased. Meanwhile, Blue Cross doubled its profits. Blue Cross Blue Shield, which covers 1 out of 3 with health insurance, not only doubled its profits in 2003, it raised its premiums 16%. It gained a surplus income of $8 billion with additional cash reserves of $32 billion. How does this happen? As you document, Jack, it's out of the hides of the poorest workers in the United States.
Yes, it's pretty common practice in the service industries, which are growing in terms of employment, where workers just don't have any kind of health insurance at all. And I interviewed, when they were in the lockout, just scores of people, and it was all the same picture as you described there. They work two jobs at a minimum. One is a union job, hopefully, where they can get some semblance of health insurance, but the other job, which is also a part-time job or temporary job, they have no insurance at all. So they have to work more than two or at least two jobs in order to make ends meet. And as you pointed out, the companies, the corporations, particularly the health insurance companies, are doing great. Health insurance corporations' profits double just about every 3 years, and they increase 20% to 40% every year. And, of course, the reason is we get hit with these record price increases by these insurance companies. Premiums, monthly premiums for workers with health insurance have increased 10% to 20% every year for the last 5 years. And in the last 5 years, workers have put out-of-pocket increases in paying for their health care coverage, while it declined, about 100% out-of-pocket increase in just the last 5 years. So there's this massive shift in the cost, which is also part of the crisis, from employers to workers, which is over and in addition to the loss of coverage.
Right.
It's the cost shift. And my calculations in the book as part of this income shift is we're looking at about $50 to $60 billion a year in cost shifting for those who still have health insurance. And that's from the Kaiser Family Study.
Right.
And this is done by shifting how much the employer requires of the employee for a contribution. For instance, the employer will say, I'll pay 75% of the cost of the health insurance and you pay 25%. Mm-hmm. And then, but my costs are going up, so your costs. Another way of doing that is the amount of copay. Let's say you're at Kaiser. You're a member of Kaiser Foundation, which provides health care in somewhat what you would expect of socialized medicine, where you go to one place and you have the doctors and the pharmacists and the X-ray and everything else. But in fact, it's a health insurance system because it's a managed care system, in fact. What you have there is the amount of copay, even for what SEIU has negotiated for the workers at Kaiser, is an increase in the copay. Instead of it being $10, you're paying $20 for every visit. And you go to a visit, and then they make you go to the lab for a test, and you pay another $10 or $20. And if you get an X-ray, it's another $10 or $20. And before you know it, your visit to the doctor, you've ended up spending $50, $60, $70 for that one visit on that day to Kaiser. And another way they also do is with Blue Cross Blue Shield is increase the deductible, which Medicare does also, is increase the deductible of how much you must have as out of pocket before your insurance even kicks in. Ralph?
Well, I mean, Jack mentioned the Kaiser Family Health Foundation report. The cost of premiums for workers with families increased 49% from 2001 to 2003, and for single workers, the premiums increased 52%, and the smaller companies imposed premium increases of 25% each year, incremental. The largest companies, 13.7, further increases per year. So, in essence, these companies are passing the rise of costs to the workers, and as you say, as Jack documents, increased copays, raising the deductibles, they're jacking up coinsurance charges for spouses and children, they remove any ceilings on payments, they call that targeting first dollar health costs. But basically, these are scams to make workers pay. So the increase of copay and the worker share, a hospital visit, it's up 50%. The deductible is up to $250 a worker, $500 for dependents. Jack documents here from the Journal of the American Medical Association that of 13 industrial countries, the United States in 2000 ranked 12th for 16 prime health care indicators and 13th in years of potential life lost, 11th in life expectancy for females, 12th in life expectancy for males, 13th infant mortality. And the study's author, Dr. Barbara Stayfield of Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, cited by Jack, declared, "It's getting worse. Each year it gets worse." By October 2004, the U.S. was ranked 36 out of 52 countries, industrial and non-industrial alike, in infant mortality. So what we've got, this is not just a crisis. This is a total assault upon the survivability of working people in the United States. 98,000 die each year from medical error, poor diagnosis, and improper treatment. 57,000 Americans die annually because of lack of health care. What we're looking at here is essentially an assault on the survival of working people in the United States. Jack, the decimation of health care and what you say about the condition of retirees cheated out of their benefits, especially with the larger corporations, is devastating.
Well, let's talk a little about who is profiting and how they're profiting, because the cost is not actually the increase of cost going to the doctors themselves. If you talk to any doctor, particularly those who receive Medicare, their reimbursement rate has gone down, which for many doctors forces them, and particularly if you're a doctor in the Kaiser system where they tell you how many patients you must see in an hour, it's forcing doctors to spend less time with their patients, and consequently, particularly with seniors, they're not getting the information from their patients as to what is really wrong with them, because they have less time to actually talk and to work with the patient. So they become like an assembly line.
Yeah, if you look at what's driving healthcare costs, it begins with the big health insurance companies. They are in the process of the last 10 years of concentration. They're buying each other out and creating monopoly pricing power. And the health insurance companies are the ones who led the run-up in the healthcare prices in the latter part of the 1990s. The drug companies quickly followed, because they saw the opportunity to mimic what they were doing. And only then do the price increases become replicated downstream in the private chain hospitals, and then the public hospitals, and then the doctors third and last. So it's the big insurance companies and drug companies who take the lead, drive the prices up, and the rest follow. If you look at the United States, in 1979, we had total health care spending of $215 billion on everything. Today, as you pointed out, the healthcare spending is about $2.2 trillion. Since this corporate offensive began, it's been a huge run-up. We spend in the United States 17% of our gross domestic product, $14 trillion a year, 17% over $2 trillion on healthcare. If you look at countries where they have universal healthcare coverage, they spend about 9% of their GDP in Europe and Canada and places like that. That means that we are spending 8-9% or about $1.2 trillion paying to middlemen, particularly the health insurance companies. They are skimming it all off the top, paying more for the insurance companies than we're actually paying for true health care services. And that 8%, 8-9% is over $1 trillion. If we had universal health care, we could immediately reduce costs by over $1 trillion. And I'll talk a little bit later, hopefully, about how we can fund that universal health care without having the insurance middlemen.
And talking about a middleman, CEO William McGuire of United Health Group, a health insurance company, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, his annual salary in 2005 was $124 million, and he was provided stock options worth more than $1.7 billion, according to Forbes.com. And I know some years ago, Blue Cross in California and shifted from being a nonprofit to a for-profit company, and the state acquiesced in that. And that then shifted how it could regulate the charges.
Well, let's take, you mentioned this, Maya, and Jack has indicated what we're essentially looking at is a handout to the corporations of subsidies and of government support for passing on all costs to the workers. Let's look what this crisis does to workers in the context of what the CEOs and executives of the healthcare operations make. Richard L. Scott of Columbia HCA received $265 million in 1 year. Peter Nicholson of Boston Scientific Corporation got $231.1 million. David Jones of Humana Inc. received $194.4 million. Leon C. Hirsch of U.S. Surgical Company was paid $105.8 million. That's just the salary. Leonard Abramson of U.S. Healthcare received stock options of $11.4 million and outright stock holdings of $783.9 million. His total compensation package was $805,122,045. The total federal spending on AIDS was $1.4 billion. Half the value of the stock holdings of the top 10 health industry executives. These payments were across the board amongst corporate conglomerates, and it is the tip of the iceberg. This is a rapine system of engorging with the survival money of the many for the obscene engorged profits of the few.
Jack, why do you think this has been allowed to happen?
Well, it's been part of the corporate offensive. You see, what we've got going on today in the last couple of decades, accelerating since the year 2000, is corporate America wants to get out of the whole business of participating and helping to provide health care insurance. The origins of health care coverage through unions and contracts on the job is really really a story of the early post-World War II period. Mm-hmm. It was in the late 1940s, early 50s that labor turned and companies turned to really providing health care and pension coverage for workers.
Well, Kaiser first provided health coverage during the war because there was a freeze on wages.
Right.
And Henry Kaiser figured that a way to attract workers was to provide benefits. And he was the first one to set up a health care system.
It was accepted practice to provide health benefits and pensions, you know, during that period. But what we have since Reagan took office is that corporations want to get out of that business, that practice altogether. They want to dump the whole provision of providing health care coverage, insurance or whatever, on the workers themselves. It's all part of this destruction of fringe benefits that have been going on. We talked about it last week where you get rid of defined benefit pension plans, which guarantee pensions to people. You eliminate those by 100,000 plus in the last 20 years, and you substitute 401k plans, where all the liability, responsibility is on the backs of the workers themselves, and management throws them a few pennies and bucks and says, go out and buy it yourself. Well, the same thing that is happening here with healthcare, the analog, the analogy to the move from defined benefit plans to 401k plans in healthcare is the move from regular historic healthcare coverage to what's called health savings accounts. It's HSAs. It's the same thing as 401Ks.
It's like the RSAs, the Retirement Savings Account with Social Security payroll.
And it was like what Bush tried to impose with Social Security, to totally privatize Social Security by creating PIAs, personal investment accounts. But the whole thrust here is to throw all the liability and responsibility on workers' backs, give them part of the money that corporations were providing before. Corporations pocket the rest of the money, and workers are pretty much on their own. With these HSAs, for example, which are corporations are driving very aggressively, and it's growing very fast. You talked about deductibles. The typical deductible in an HSA program is $2,000 per dependent per year.
Right, and often $5,000.
Often five. You know, they were jacking up monthly premiums. Now they're turning to jacking up deductibles and co-pays and second,
And this is medical. It doesn't even touch what is health care. I mean, what is dental
No,
insurance.
We're just talking about health care. Same thing's happening in dental. But this is what Bush calls the ownership society. you know?
Well, let's talk about that ownership, because in essence, as you show, Jack, the corporations simply refuse to accept any of the cost of accelerating health care premiums. They have a shell game of raising the copays, the deductibles, lowering the ceilings. They refuse to provide coverage as a way of eliminating costs. So what in essence has occurred is that ever increasing numbers of workers have to pick up the entire cost of dependents coverage, spouses, children, elderly parents. The retirees are being screwed, cheated out of their benefits. The larger corporations, as you show, with over 200 employees, 66% of the larger corporations provided health coverage for retirees in 1988. By 2002, it had fallen to 5%. And then you have elimination of all coverage for the retirees announced unilaterally by Lucent Corporation, the telecom equipment giant, and by the major airlines, United, Delta, US Air, as well as by IBM and AT&T. They set the pace. So we have here a corporate onslaught. In fact, Wall Street Journal said that it's something that is never going to be recovered. For 2005, the journal said, employers concede they are shifting health care costs to workers, and there is little let up in sight.
Jack, we had discussed last week with the evolution of Social Security. Originally, the intention by the major unions was that it should be social. In other words, provided by society. Pension should be provided by society. It's Social Security. And yet, through first the United Mine Workers and then the United Auto Workers, the shift was negotiate with employers. And at that time, the employers needed the workers, and so they provided the benefits. And now you're talking about the corporations with the lessening of the power of unions through the offensive by the government, particularly, and the corporate offensive. The shift is, why do we have to pay? Let's shift it to the workers. And there is a move completely away from the notion of social responsibility, that is, society bearing the responsibility for providing for pensions and also health care. Let's discuss this a little before we go on in the second half of the show to what is to be done.
Yes. Well, you know, let's go back to the figure of how much we're spending in this country, $2.3 trillion on health care. About half of that is going to the insurance companies and other middlemen. So if we were to move to a universal health care program, single payer. I'm not talking about universal health insurance, because you still got all those middlemen and they'll figure a way to continue paying them that $1 trillion.
Well, that's what the Democrats want to do. They want to subsidize health care coverage for children and the needy by giving the money to insurers, providers, drug manufacturers, and underwriting them with federal funds and guarantees at taxpayer expense, so the corporate pirates can increase their excessive pricing and give less and less care.
And even the New York Times came out this weekend attacking the privatization of Medicare. Again, that was shifting the federal dollars to the health insurance companies to provide Medicare services.
Right. But if we were to go for a single payer, universal health care, without health insurance, without the middlemen, we would have to raise about $1.2 trillion in order to do that. If we follow the example of GDPs and other advanced industrial economies,
gross domestic product,
right, spend about 9%, you know, of their total on universal health care, their total GDP. So the question is, how do you, if you go to universal health care, how do you raise $1.1 trillion? Well, I've done some calculations on this, and you can easily raise about $1.6 trillion by doing the following. First of all, you eliminate the payroll tax for Social Security altogether, give workers a 15% immediate pay increase. Then you turn around and you levy a 7.5% surtax on all forms of income, all forms, capital incomes as well as you know, wages and salary incomes. I'm talking about capital gains, dividends, interest, rent, and so forth. You know, on the bottom of your 1040 form, line 32, 7.5%. Everybody pays 7.5%. you would be able to raise about $800 billion a year just by doing that, which would enable you to fund Social Security retirement and start the funding of universal health care. Now, in addition to that, if you close these offshore tax shelters in which there's $7 trillion that have been shuffled offshore.
That we know about.
That we know about. It's probably higher than that. And that produces a flow of income at normal interest rates of about $200 billion a year. And if you put a penalty on them not bringing back, that $7 trillion, that will raise another $100 billion. So there's $300 billion there. And then if you tax corporate profits retention, which is about $500 billion a year being kept, that would raise another $100 billion. And through various other means, disallowing the transfer of the lockbox, we would be able to raise about $1.5 to $1.7 trillion. You would be able to fund not only the universal health care single payer, but prescription drugs for everybody, and in addition, to be able to finance Social Security retirement.
This is Taking AIM with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Class War at Home, Part 3, The Crisis in Healthcare and What is to be Done. We conclude today with our conversation with Jack Rasmus. Jack Rasmus is on the National Executive Board of the National Writers Union, UAW 1981. He is the chair of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Writers Union. And Jack is the author of plays and particularly this book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush, which discusses economic class war in America. We've discussed in the first part of the program today the crisis in healthcare, and Jack just now articulated a very good analysis of how health care could be provided universally in the United States with taxation that is not regressive as most taxation is today in the U.S. Aside from talking about what is to be done in health care, we want to discuss the global issue of what is to be done to correct the problems of work in the United States, the problems of pension, the problems of health care. Ralph?
Well, Maya, Jack was indicating how a universal health care coverage from cradle to grave, single payer, would provide health care at a fraction of what it costs today. And, I mean, that very dramatically indicates what corporate capitalism represents, the rapine exploitation and deepening crisis, survival crisis for the mass of our population. I mean, what Jack indicated is that a single-payer system would cut health care costs by one-third at $600 billion a year, which is based on eliminating profit gouging. Then there's the stolen Social Security surplus that was used to further subsidize corporate capitalist economics. That's at $1.2 trillion a year. The corporate theft from the lockbox of Social Security, the borrowed surplus from the payroll tax, which is stolen to pay for the arms budget, the invasion of Iraq, the tax cuts for the corporations and the rich, that's another $1.4 trillion. Just the interest on this, $100 billion a year, would pay for single payer. If the wealthiest 10% of taxpayers paid the same 12.4% payroll tax on their gross income as 100 million U.S. households do, that's another $350 billion a year in revenue. $525 billion could be raised by making everyone pay the same percent of their income. Huh? How about if the rich pay the same percent of their income as the poor do? $1.4 trillion in the Social Security surplus would be restored. You could go on and on, but let's talk about this very specifically. If these corporations were nationalized and under workers' control, if there was a democratic control of our economy, if we replace corporate capitalism with a democratic socialism in production for human need, we transform every society, including our own. You have 60 million people living on under $7 a day, 100 million people losing health care, pensions, secure work, and affordable housing and viable schools. This is the engine force for the vast majority of people who work and produce all value to transform this society. Jack, it's not a question of if, but when. How do we mobilize our vast constituency, the enormous, overwhelming majority of working people who produce everything of value, to take back this society?
Well, that question raises, in turn, the immediate question of the strategy of the American labor movement and what it's done, what the strategy has been for the last half century, particularly since the 1980s. And it's really an indictment of traditional business unionism. You know, there was a time when the American labor movement was committed to Social Security, as we talked about, and to making it the retirement health care solution. And it was in the post-war period, as I mentioned later, earlier, that the shift from this whole strategy occurred. And unions went their separate ways just for their respective industries and union members, and negotiated health plans, pension plans, and so forth, and pretty much abandoned working through the objective of making Social Security a social approach to the whole solution. And in fact, the destructions of the pension plans, the retirement system, the dismantling of that system, and the healthcare system today are probably the best historic indictment of the failure of that particular approach, trying to negotiate through contracts and through working deals with employers healthcare and retirement coverages. And we are really at the end of that road. You see, that sort of approach where you take the whole idea of contracts, and I'm in favor of union contracts. I negotiate union contracts. But to take it as a tactic and to raise it to a level of the strategy for the labor movement, just negotiate contracts, mm-hmm. I think is a major historic error. I think what we need to do is to build a new kind of a union movement in this country and a new kind of a concept of what a union member is. You know, right now we're organized in stovepipes.
What do you mean by stovepipes?
Stovepipes. I mean, we got the auto worker stovepipe. We got the steel worker stovepipe. We got the healthcare worker stovepipe. And we tend to stay isolated within those occupations in those industries. You know, the central labor councils are really ineffective. People go to the central labor council to get a strike sanctioned, and they walk away. And there's no solidarity actions that follow that getting strike.
Well, there
sanctioned.
Were laws passed against what they called secondary strikes.
Well, look.
Ralph, let him address that first.
Well, that's only one of the many efforts that were imposed in the post-World War II period to eliminate the solidarity between unions and between workers and other workers, and to pretty much neutralize the militancy of American labor, which they effectively did in the 1950s. Any of the growth in the union movement after that was just growth in certain industries. But you look at what's happened today from a 22% of the workforce organized, unionized in 1980. Today we're down to 7% in the private sector. We've lost 14 million members. And they pretty much destroyed industry-wide bargaining, which was the strength of labor in manufacturing, construction, and transportation. People don't realize, you know, there was a time in the late 1960s, early 70s, when labor went on national strikes across the country for national bargaining agreements. Construction unions, the Teamsters had a national freight agreement, auto workers had a national agreement, steel workers did. And there was a strike wave that occurred in 1970-71 in which workers won, listen to this, folks, more than 20% wage and benefit increases in just the first year of a three-year agreement. Can you imagine those kind of increases in wages and benefits today? Well, what happened as a result of that strike wave is that the corporations turned around in the remainder of the 70s and said, we're never going to allow that to happen again. They had Nixon, the president at that time, put on a wage freeze, and then they went after the unions to bust them in that strategic core of construction, manufacturing, and transport. And that was the legacy of the Reagan years, to do that, to bust those unions and to balkanize collective bargaining, destroy industry-wide agreements. And they effectively did that. Workers fought back in the 1980s, but they fought back on a plant-by-plant, company-by-company basis, and they were defeated. And the big strategic historic failure of labor in the 1980s under Reagan was that they thought Reagan was just temporary. They did not see that this offensive came from the corporations in a very collective manner itself, and it wasn't going to go away. And the big historic failure of the 80s was labor did not see this as a strategic assault on the House of Labor by corporate America and respond collectively to that assault. They waited.
Yes, Jack, but look, there's a 13-to-1 differential between what labor functionaries earn and what rank-and-file workers earn. You have had the bureaucracy of the trade union movement with a totally autocratic structure channeling all labor's political efforts into the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party, not just Reagan, after all, has been the architect of these employer-dominant relations with working people, where workers now are not in a position, nor do their leaders allow them to galvanize support for the steel workers by the auto workers, for the machinists by the coal workers, by the coal miners. The corporations are locked in for cross-industry price fixing, profit gouging, and total capture of the government. So then you have the trade union bureaucracy channeling the workers into the arms of the Democratic Party, which presides over dismantling the gains that they had fought for when they were organizing across industry in the 30s. With the no-strike pledges of the 40s, all of this is a thing of the past. So it's Reagan, sure, but what do they do with PATCO? They probe, they push, they go as far as they can. If they don't meet resistance, they go further. The Democrats lie down and spread their legs for this. And the corporate bureaucrats respond by doing what? Every four-year ritual, hundreds of millions of dollars are extracted from workers and channeled into the Democratic Party. Where does this go for working people? They've got no. Hey, what did the Labor Party, when it was formed, say? The bosses of two parties? We need one of our own. So how can working people fight back without a political instrument of their own? After all, we are the vast majority of the society, the overwhelming majority, union people, working people, the unorganized, the community at large, vast, overwhelming majority, the 90-95% of the population of this country, this handful of people that have been gouging us, that have captured the government, that command both political parties, that fund them, for which these trade union functionaries serve with basically delivering workers with sweetheart contracts over the ranks. Isn't that what we have to address? The lack of democratic control by rank-and-file workers, the absence of a political response. We need to fight in our own name. We need to be able to mobilize around our own issues, surely.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with a lot of what you're saying. You know, the essence of business unionism is not just focusing strategically just on contracts, but it means trying to cut deals with employers. It means collaboration. And the political reflection of that, as you point out, is total reliance politically on the Democratic Party and legislation. And it's interesting to watch they're trying to get labor law reform passed. Well, they couldn't get it passed under Carter when they had both houses of Congress and the presidency.
Right. They're trying for Karchuk.
Yeah. And I doubt whether much is going to come of the current legislative efforts trying to do the same. I think what needs to happen is labor needs to link up in new ways and new forms with new structures with community and community struggles and community activists. As I said, we're stuck in these contracts and stovepipe unionism really keeps us isolated from each other. In other words, it prevents us from really engaging in solidarity actions. What labor needs to do is create new local mobilization committees that would integrate community struggles for schools and for housing and so forth with union fights for contracts and organizing and strikes, support and so forth. In my book, I talk about local mobilization committees as a parallel structure focusing on solidarity actions on a regional, local basis. There has to be a structure. It can't be ad hoc. You know, it can't be, okay, let's try to mobilize people when we got you know, strike here going on at Berkeley Honda, and then everyone goes away. They go somewhere else. Or let's try to go out there and do something about the Oakland schools, and then everyone goes away. It's too spontaneous. It's too ad hoc. There has to be a local structure with full-time organizers who are from the community, not just from labor. But they have to have resources. They have to have, you know, get paid something. And we have to create within the union movement a new idea of what a union member is. The very best and most conscious and militant people have to see themselves as not a member of SEIU or not a member of Steelworkers, but a member of the American labor movement. They're going to be the leading elite, if you would, of the American labor movement and build these local solidarity actions across unions and with the community. And a new concept of what a union member is has to be created that is based on the whole idea of solidarity actions across labor with the community, because the people in the community are workers too.
Well, you're both talking about the same thing, because this is unions from the base. It incorporates each and every worker as opposed to bureaucratic unionism, which is top down and which leads to getting in bed with the bosses because you're negotiating man to man, and also, as what happened with the UAW, sitting on the boards of the corporations themselves.
And when you have this kind of a grassroots movement where on a local level, you know, union people and workers in the community are fighting together on mutual interest, supporting each other in an act of solidarity fashion, and you build that kind of a local movement and local mobilization committees, once you have that movement going, then you can get together and say, okay, now what kind of a political party do we want to flow from this? But you can't impose a political third party from the top down. It has to come from a social movement from the bottom up. There has to be a structure for that movement. There has to be resources for that movement. And the people themselves from the bottom up have to determine the strategy and tactics.
Well, look, Jack, right now, for example, in South Carolina, a labor party has been formed. Our Donna DeWitt, who is the chair of the AFL-CIO Labor Council for the state of South Carolina, is involved with this. Even Mark Dudzik of the Labor Party has been engaged with this. Now, we've had our own experiences with Dudzik, who wouldn't even go near the Million Worker March and didn't want to break with the Democrats, even though he's nominally the head of a labor party. But to concretize what you're talking about here, let's just really look at what the trade union bureaucracy does. If you take what was called the war zone, you remember the cat workers strike and the Firestone workers strike, yes?
In Decatur,
Illinois. Now, the Caterpillar workers were fighting to preserve their health care and to preserve what they'd fought for young people and the next generation of workers. And Caterpillar was on a march to eliminate all that, and the workers went on strike. UAW, we're both, you and I and Mai are in the UAW, we're in the Writers Union, which is the UAW. Let me tell you, the cat workers strike, and that was a real old-fashioned struggle with the goons brought out, with heads being busted, with the cops out there trying to break, and the families mobilizing in tents on that strike line, and Caterpillar was down to 24 hours of inventory, and the outsourcing, which had been a feature of how Caterpillar had dealt with working people, sending jobs out to Brazil where they could pay workers a third. The Sao Paulo Caterpillar workers sent a message to Owen Bieber, the head of the UAW. We want to come out in support of the U.S. workers in Peoria. Huh? And they asked for what? They asked for some strike fund support so their families could pay their rent while they came out in support. A $1.2 billion strike fund in the United Auto Workers, and Bieber wouldn't give them a nickel. He signed a deal with Caterpillar over the head of the ranks. Those workers were in a survival struggle that spoke for all of labor. And we, Maya and I, were at the 30th anniversary convention of the UAW in Los Angeles. And those cat workers marched in there with their banners, and Bieber cut off the mics. What was the message? Leave it to Bieber. Huh? You're dealing here with a corporate, bureaucratic, trade union bureaucracy that's in bed with the bosses, and that's the function of the Democratic Party. Of course it has to be rank and file. Of course it has to be bottom up. But you got to have a struggle for the democratization of the trade union movement. You got to have a rank and file movement that is political from its get-go with a $1.2 billion strike fund, Jack. Think about what labor could do with its own system of communications. We could have our own radio stations, our own newspapers. We wouldn't have to be doing marginal broadcasting, important as it is, on public-supported free speech radio. Workers' wages, workers' dues, which are flowing into the trade union movement and handed over to the Democratic Party and to the privileges of these bureaucrats who are, what, as Lenin called them, labor lieutenants of capital. Isn't this the real essence of the struggle before us, to mobilize our rank and file for a movement of our own, for a political expression of our own, our vast resources that could be deployed for our political self-expression, controlled by the bureaucrats?
Well, as I said, I don't disagree in that we have to create a social movement, and we have to do it from the grass level up. You can't rely on the heads of unions to launch this kind of a movement. You know, you talk about Caterpillar, but just look what's going on now in the auto industry. You got 100,000 auto jobs that have been lost this year, another 100,000 next year, and no actions going on. There's a fear of turning the rank and file loose to fight the companies. They don't want to rely on the rank and file to go ahead and come up creatively with solutions to put pressure on the companies to stop this. I mean, they're dismantling the auto industry in this country and right in front of our eyes and moving it to China and India, going on right now.
Sure.
And what's the response? I mean, you know, I think the leaders of the UAW have bought the idea from GM that GM can't afford to employ auto workers in the U.S. But I know for a fact that the books that GM has showed the UAW leadership is only for North America. GM and Ford, they are profitable globally. And rather than looking at the global profitability of these companies, mm-hmm. they've fallen for the line that they can't afford it in the United States. So they've already reduced retirees' health benefits, and bargaining coming up, they'll probably reduce regular health benefits and pensions for auto workers. It's
and also accept two-tier.
Two-tier? Well, they already have two-tier. And they already have tens of thousands, 100,000 almost of temporary workers.
Two-tier means that new workers,
don't have
young
health,
workers,
yeah.
don't have
right,
the same
right.
benefits as...
Well, Jack.
But the answer has to come from the grassroots. It has to come from the grassroots. And it has to, you know, the other premise is it has to be not just unionized members. It has to be the community, and it has to be mutual struggles between union members and community, and create a new kind of solidarity actions and solidarity movements on a local regional basis and a structure to support that.
Which that is the best way to unionize.
And from that, hopefully, will come a new political form of organization that will challenge the two reigning parties.
Well,
you can't impose it from the top down.
No, but then that's the imposition from the top down is what the trade union bureaucrats have tried to do. And after all, the trade union officialdom since the 30s looks to the bosses and says, give us something to buy some labor peace and we'll deliver our ranks to you. But what we're describing here with outsourcing and NAFTA and CAFTA and all of these so-called free trade schemes with the mad race to the sweatshop bottom is precisely to whipsaw workers and pit workers against each other, right? So what are we faced with here? The boundaries of nation are not respected by the capitalist ruling class. Corporate capitalism shifts jobs to where they pay the people sweatshop labor wages, and then they whipsaw workers here and say, get lean and mean, or the job goes to China or to Mexico or to Guatemala or wherever. So obviously what we're faced with here is a global capitalist offensive. Capital has been global since Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto. Workers need to have an organized international fight back. It's not a question of charity. It's a question of survival. The survival of workers in Sao Paulo, Brazil, when the workers in Brazil said, we want to come out in support of the cat workers, they understood what was at stake if the cat workers were broken in the United States. The UAW in St. Paul, Minnesota, sent down organizers to Toluca, Mexico, to help organize Mexican workers, because they understood that the bosses are global. So, Jack, don't we need to have an international worker fight back and use the resources to fund the political struggles that we require?
Absolutely. It has to be international because capital is global now. And, you know, this idea of stovepipe unions just in the U.S. is nonsense for that reason as well. It's not mutually exclusive. It's not one or the other. It has to be an international effort, but there also has to be a rebuilding of the whole labor movement from the bottom up. And that's what I mean about local mobilization committees. And that's not the be-all and panacea and solution to everything either. You have to do this on a number of fronts. But until we can do that locally and build a social movement ourselves, the rest is all academic.
Okay, Jack. Well, that's the struggle ahead of us. Rank-and-file organizing, the political challenge to the monopoly of politics by the capitalist parties. The way forward is struggle. It always has been, it always will be, and the task ahead of us is huge, but the crisis of capitalism is greater.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Class War at Home, Part 3, The Crisis in Healthcare and What is to be Done, concludes our three-part conversation with Jack Rasmus. Jack is author of The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush. You can purchase The Class War at Home at www.kyklosproductions.com. That's KYKLOSPRODUCTIONS.com and at Amazon.com. And please, also at KeyCloseProductions.com, you're going to find more articles that we refer to here on Taking Aim by Jack Rasmus. Also, visit our website where there are links to Jack's website, and that's www.TakingAimRadio.com.